We're going to read from 1 John now. 1 John chapter 2, verses 3 to 11. Those of you who are under 18, there are going to be a few questions for you tonight, opportunities for you to answer some questions. So you'll need a Bible open in front of you to be able to answer the question. You'll need to answer from 1 John chapter 2. So have that ready. As we go through the sermon, there'll be a couple of points where I'll ask you one or two questions. So 1 John 2, I'm going to read verses 3 to 11, that's our section for tonight. Now by this we know that we know him, if we keep his commandments. He who says, I know him, and does not keep his commandments, is a liar, and the truth is not in him. But whoever keeps his word, truly the love of God is perfected in him. By this we know that we are in him. He who says he abides in him ought himself also to walk, just as he walked. Brethren, I write no new commandment to you, but an old commandment, which you have had from the beginning. The old commandment is the word which you heard from the beginning. Again, a new commandment I write to you, which thing is true in him and in you, because the darkness is passing away, and the true light is already shining. He who says he is in the light and hates his brother is in darkness until now. He who loves his brother abides in the light, and there is no cause for stumbling in him. But he who hates his brother is in darkness and walks in darkness and does not know where he is going, because the darkness has blinded his eyes. I can take you back to 1945, World War II. The Japanese were on the back foot, and the Americans sent them a message saying, will you surrender? And they received a one-word answer back from the Japanese. And the word was mokusatsu. I've no idea how it's meant to be pronounced, but that's how I'm pronouncing it, mokusatsu. And the word means, we withhold comment, pending discussion. In other words, we've received your message, we're going to discuss it, and we will come back to you with an answer. But unfortunately, the American translator then mistranslated it back to the Americans, and he translated it as, we are treating your message with contempt. Bit of a difference between the two. That was what led to President Truman authorizing the dropping of the atomic bomb on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. A mistranslation of a single word. And you know, we can face that sort of danger for ourselves as Christians when it comes to looking at 1 John. That we can read it, and sometimes without even realizing it, twist it on its head, twist it 180 degrees round. We've got to keep on reminding ourselves what the purpose of 1 John is. Why did John write it? We looked at these verses before, right at the start. I write these things that your joy may be full. So joy. And then right at the end of the book, he says, these things I've written to you who believe in the name of the Son of God, that you may know you have eternal life. Joy, assurance, that's what he's after. But you know, there are times when we can read 1 John and mistranslate it without realizing it, and that it can have the opposite sort of effect on us. But John wants Christians to be reassured. You do know him. You do belong to him. Now, Christians are, John says, to be characterized by three things. These are three things we're going to keep on seeing as we go through this book. Christians are to be characterized, firstly, by right living, obedience. Secondly, Christians are to be characterized by right loving, loving other believers. And thirdly, by right believing, what you actually believe, who you actually believe in. So right living, right loving, right believing. Those are three of the big themes in 1 John. But you know what one of our problems is? One of the things we sometimes do is we want to add more to that list. We've got three things, three evidences of faith. We want to add more into it. You know how sometimes in court cases where the judge listens to them and says, no, that evidence is inadmissible. I'm not going to let that into my court. Well, sometimes we bring in all these extra things as well as those three. And, well, the judge would say, well, no, I'm not giving you any other. These are the three things, the three evidences of faith. We do all sorts of other things. This might be something we could talk about later. What other evidences do we bring in? What other signs do we look for? Do we look at our feelings? We think, how saved do I feel today? We look at whether we've had a good week as a Christian or a bad week as a Christian. Do we count up how many times we've read our Bible this week? And if we feel we've done well, it gives us assurance. And if we think we've done badly, we think, well, maybe I'm not really a Christian. So we've got to keep reminding ourselves, John doesn't give us that or any of those things as a sign of evidence. Do you know what we end up doing sometimes is the equivalent of an Olympic high jump competition setting the bar. Now, I would say about up here, but actually they can jump up here, so I can't even reach as high as some of them jump, I suspect. Setting it 3 metres high, something that no one can possibly jump over. We almost do that as Christians sometimes. We set the bar ridiculously high, and in a sense, it's because we can be so sensitive to our sin, which is a good thing. And then we can become so dangerously introspective, we're constantly looking at ourselves, weighing things up, weighing each thing, and asking ourselves lots of questions, setting the bar so high that actually no one would be able to jump over it. Now, children, I said I had some questions for you. Here's some questions for, well, again, anyone who's under the age of 18 can answer this. Now, those verses we just read in 1 John 2, if you look at verse 4, is anyone able to tell me what are, I haven't asked the question yet, what are the first three words of verse 4? Go on, Caleb, what are the first three words? He who says. Okay. Now look at verse 6. What are the first three words of verse 6? Caleb. Elijah, sorry. Wrong name. Elijah, first three words of verse 6.
He who says.
He who says. Okay. Let's do the last one all together. First three words of verse 9. What are they?
He who says.
All together. Thank you. Okay. Now, who is it John's talking about? He says, he who says. Well, he's responding to what the false teachers at the time were saying. Three times he's saying, those false teachers, they say such and such. He's responding to their lies and their half-truths, things that were unsettling genuine believers. Yeah, I think they must have been saying things like, oh, you'll know if you're a Christian, because you'll get some sort of mystical experience. You'll get some gooey feeling inside. Or you'll know when you're a Christian because you just won't struggle with sin anymore like you do at the moment. You won't have those sort of daily battles and temptations. Do you know what they were doing? They were introducing more sets of evidence. Those three that John gives, no, we'll add more things to the list. Have you had these mystical experiences? So tonight, in the verses we're looking at, John picks up on two of those three strings of evidence I've just mentioned. The evidence of right living, and then the evidence of right loving. So that's going to be our structure tonight. But with both of them, what we need to say is, what is John saying, and what isn't John saying? So we're going to look at both those two. We're going to look at what John is saying and then what John isn't saying. So the first one is in verses 3 to 6, the evidence of right living. What is John saying? What is he positively saying in verses 3 to 6? Well, to put it very simply, he is saying the way you live is evidence one way or the other as to whether you know God or not. Verse 3. By this we know that we know him, if we keep his commandments. Verse 4, he who says I know him and does not keep his commandments, well, he's a liar. The truth isn't in him. That can't be the case, he says. Verse 5, someone who does keep the word of God, truly the love of God is perfected in him. By that, perfected means made complete or whole. So I think the gist of what he's saying there is, when you keep God's word and you do what he says, God's love is evident in you. God's love is completed in you. That's the purpose. God sends his love into your life so that you obey him. That's the direction of his love. He says, verse 5. Same thing again. By this we know that we are in him. We said this before. John does sort of repeat similar themes. And you see it in these verses. Verses 3, 4, 5. He's saying the same sort of thing, just in different words. By this we know that we are in him. Here's the evidence. Verse 6. You should walk as Jesus walks. So Jesus lived a life of obedience to his Father. Well, that means a believer's life will be one of obedience to the Father. Jesus lived a life of sacrifice, and so must we. And that's evidence that we're his. Jesus is a fleshed out example of what obedience to God looks like in practice. So that's what John is saying. The evidence of a Christian life is fruit. A life characterized by obedience to Jesus. A life that looks like Jesus' life. But I think if we only go that far, I think there's more we can do here by thinking about what John isn't saying. Now, quick survey. Hands up for me. Is there anyone here tonight who just said that being a Christian means being like Jesus? Anyone here tonight who would look at their own life? Imagine you sort of, you've got your life there, Jesus' life there, and you keep looking between the two, and you think, yeah, I can't see any difference. My walk is just like Jesus's. I'm just like him. No. Good. Well done. So that leaves us with a question then, doesn't it? What is he saying then? If he's saying on the one hand, does that mean that none of us are Christians? Because none of us can say we're completely like Jesus. Well, do you think they would have been able to answer that question that way in John's day? The Christians he's writing to, do you think they would have been able to say, yeah, I walk just like Jesus walked? No, and that's not what John's... You've got to think a bit more about what John is getting at. John said back in chapter 1, yeah, you will sin. We will sin. That's why he says, good news, there is an advocate. We do have an advocate. This is where I go back to what we were saying before. If we're not careful, this can make us panic. Because we can look at Jesus' life, we look at our life, we think, well, I'm so far off him, maybe I'm not saved, maybe I'm not a believer. And we can get ourselves tangled up in knots as we look at our failures. We look at the ways we sin, we think, I don't measure up to Jesus in this way, that way. Because let's be honest, we can all make really long lists of how we don't measure up to Jesus. But actually we need to look at how John is putting it here. Don't ask yourself, is there evidence of failure and disobedience in my life? That's not what John tells us to do here. But that's what we almost always end up doing, I think. We look at our lives, we think, well, is there evidence that we fail and sin? Yes. And then we start to worry. Don't ask, is there evidence of disobedience? John says, ask, is there evidence of obedience? You see, there's a subtle difference, but it's actually a very important one. Is there evidence of obedience, not just disobedience? That is an important distinction. And there's something else too. Okay, I can think about obedience. How much obedience do I need to have? And then we start going down that line, and we start totting up our points totals, and we start doing charts where we put that, well, on the one hand, I'm doing well with my church attendance, I think that's good, but my Bible reading, yeah, that's, maybe that goes into the disobedience column. But then, on the other hand, I'm a very loving person, I'm very sacrificial towards my friends and family, but on the other hand, oh, that sermon about adoption and caring for vulnerable people and widows that we heard this morning, I'd have to put that in the other column. And we put things into our different columns and we think, how much obedience does there need to be? But notice again, John doesn't put it that way. He doesn't say, is there enough obedience? He simply says, is there obedience? If we're people who do keep his commands, if there is evidence of obedience to Christ, he's saying, be reassured. Because true obedience to Jesus Christ can only really come when we've got the Spirit in us. Now, it's if you can't see any of that, if you can't think of a time you chose to obey Jesus Christ, can't think of a time when there was a right and a wrong, an obedient and a disobedient way forward, and you chose the obedient because you want to follow him, if you can't think of a single time you've done that, well, actually, that's when you need to say to yourself, am I kidding myself? I've never obeyed him. And that's when you are in a very dangerous position. So John's question he asks is there evidence that you obey his commands? He's not asking you, is there evidence of disobedience? Because no one would pass that test. Let's move on to the second one in verses 7 to 11. We've talked about the evidence of right living. Now it's the evidence of right loving. And firstly, we'll think about what John is saying. Now, verse 7. Griff, question for you from verse 7. Is that okay, Griff? Question in verse 7. What type of commandment in verse 7 is John giving them? What type of commandment does it say? And not verse 7. Have a look at verse 7. Read a little bit farther. I write no new commandment to you, but an old commandment. So verse 7, John says, I'm writing an old commandment. Okay, Max, look at verse 8 for me, Max. What type of commandment does it say in verse 8 John is giving them there? A new commandment. Is anyone confused? Griff said it's an old commandment, and it does say that in verse 7. And now Max says in verse 8, it's a new commandment. Has John had a memory problem here? Because he says straight away, old, and then he says immediately after that, new. Well, we need to work out what he's saying here then, don't we? How can it be old and new as a commandment? Well, imagine Max, I gave you a present one day. Imagine I gave you a book. And I said to you, Max, happy birthday, it's your birthday, I got you a new book. And you opened it up, and as you looked at it, it was really tatty, and some of the pages were falling out. I said, yeah, I found this book in a charity shop. It's from the 1980s, but it's all about farming. And Max, I know you love farming, so there's your book. Now, is it a new book or is it an old book? Well, it's both, isn't it? It's a new book for you, Max, but it's an old book because it was written in the 1980s, if that makes sense. So this commandment, John is saying it's old and it's new. First, he says in verse 7, it's an old commandment. He says it's one which you've had from the beginning. So, look, I'm not springing something new on you here. You've had this commandment from the day you believed. Right when we preached the gospel to you, when you first came to know Jesus, you've had this command. It's an old commandment. I'm not just suddenly making up some new standards for you. And verses 9 to 11, he tells them what it is. Verse 9, you can't say you're in the light, but hate your brother. But if you love your brother, you are living in the light. So it's a command about loving our brothers and sisters. That's actually, if you hate your brother, you're in darkness. You'll stumble. You won't know where you're going. So this is the second evidence John is saying for us to look for. To love your brothers and sisters. Nothing new there. When you first came to Christ, it was one of the things we first said, John said, you need to love each other. Nothing new here. But then verse 8, he also says it's a new commandment. A new commandment, which thing is true in him and in you. I think what he's getting at here is this is a truth that is seen in Jesus and in you. It finds its full expression in Jesus and in the life of his people, this commandment to love one another. So, why is he calling it a new commandment then? What does he mean by new? And that's when we have to go back to John 13, because you notice in John 13, that's exactly how Jesus describes it. Back in John 13, which we read earlier, Jesus knows his death is imminent. He's going to depart from this world. The disciples are gathered all around him, and he washes their feet. He washes their feet. He shows them how to love. And then, towards the end of the passage we read, he says, "A new commandment I give you." He says this phrase three times, love one another. "A new commandment I give you, that you love one another. As I have loved you, that you also love one another. By this all will know that you're my disciples, if you have love for one another." Now when Jesus was asked about the Ten Commandments, he summarized the commandments as being all about love. The greatest command, love God. What's the next one after that? Love your neighbour, love others, love your neighbour as yourself. Now, that summarised the Ten Commandments. And think about some of the commandments towards the end of the list of the Ten Commandments. They're all about loving your neighbour. So in Old Testament Israel, when those Ten Commandments were given, that was all about loving people you lived in that community with. Fellow Israelites. Don't steal from them. Don't lie to them. Don't kill them. Don't covet their possessions. Love your neighbour. Love them as yourself. But you know what? In Old Testament Israel, you had a mixed community. They weren't all believers. They were God's people. They were his covenant people. But quite a lot of them, you read the Old Testament, it's very clear, they weren't believers. They had no personal relationship with God. But you had to treat every Israelite well, whether they knew God personally or not, whether you even knew them. You wouldn't have known by name every Israelite, would you? But the command was between all of them. Love all your fellow Israelites. And that was a good and a right and a beautiful law. But now in John 13, we've got the 11th commandment, if you want to put it that way. A new commandment. And he says three times, love one another. And he's not talking in that verse about loving everyone out there in the world, loving your teacher or your dentist or your next door neighbour or your tennis coach. By all means, love them and be kind to them, but it's not what he's talking about there. He's talking to his disciples. Judas has walked out the door. It's just his faithful disciples left there, and he's telling them to love each other, his disciples. And he calls it the new commandment. Because, you know, it is something brand new for them. It doesn't perhaps feel new to us, does it? But it was radically new for them. Old Testament Israel, the command was to love everyone in Israel, whether they knew God personally or not. But here's a command Jesus gives just for those who know him. To love believers in a special way. To live a life characterized by love. For those people in particular, your brothers and sisters, and to live a sacrificial life for them. A sacrifice for other people is not unique, is it? Do you know where I think we see sacrifice in our society, and in fact, probably every society, more than anywhere else? It's in families. You know, we see sons and daughters caring for their elderly parents, as they're in the care home, or visiting them in the hospital with all their ailments, showing sacrificial love for them. That wouldn't strike you as unusual, would it? If you went into the hospital and you saw a son visiting his elderly mother, you wouldn't go, "Oh, wow!" You'd think, "Well, that's good. That's good." You wouldn't be shocked, would you? You wouldn't be shocked if you saw a mum changing her baby's nappy. Would you? You'd think, "Well, that's good and that's kind and rather her than me," but you wouldn't be shocked by it, would you? Yes, it is sacrificial. Yeah, it's not pleasant. You wouldn't be surprised, would you, if you saw a dad working really hard, trying to earn enough money to set up his children well financially, so that one day he can help them on their first mortgage and get them on the property ladder. You'd say, yeah, that's a good thing. It's right for that dad to be sacrificial, but you know, it's nothing shocking, is it? Because we see those sorts of sacrifices all the time in family life, and they're good and they're right things, but it's nothing unusual. Do you know what is unusual, though, is to see that sort of sacrifice outside of the family setting. What is really startling and mind-boggling is to see people who didn't grow up in the same community, who didn't go to the same school, who don't support the same football team, who don't canvass for the same political party, who didn't know each other from Adam until the moment they came to Christ. Those sorts of people coming together and showing that sort of love for each other, that's the sort of thing that would make you stand up and notice. If you saw someone giving away their car to their daughter, think, well, that's nicer than to give their car away. If you saw them giving away their car to someone they'd only met a few weeks ago, but was a fellow believer in Christ and who needed a car, that would make you think again, wouldn't it? Sacrificial love for someone who isn't a close friend, who's not a family member. That's the sort of love Jesus is talking about here. And the picture he uses is one of foot washing. Imagine foot washing, dirty, dusty, smelly. How would you feel if at the porch tonight I'd said, don't just shake hands, please, before they come in. Colin, if you're on the door tonight, Peter, if you're on the door, you need to take their shoes off first. And whoever it is, yeah, maybe Griff has been playing rugby and maybe hasn't had a shower for a month. And wash everyone's feet on the way in, would you? It's a humbling sort of thing to do, foot washing. It's a sacrificial sort of love. See, John's saying, if you only love your family in a sacrificial way, well, good on you, it's good to do that. But that is not evidence of a changed heart. If you only love your close, tight-knit friendship group in that way, great, but the world has that sort of love too. What sets aside Christians, what makes people stand up and notice, Jesus says, by this all people will know that you're my disciples, if you love each other. That's what sets the church apart. Now, what John isn't saying here is much the same as before. Have you ever sinned towards another Christian before? Yeah, you have. I have. We have. So John's not saying here, well, if you've sinned here, never mind, you can't be a Christian, can you? No, he's not saying that, but he is saying, is there evidence of love? Could you say, yeah, I do love them? And he's not saying try to measure how much you love them. Try to quantify your feelings and your emotions and try and ask yourself, well, do I love Christians more this week than I did last week? He's not asking you to measure your love tank to see how full up it is or anything like that. He's not saying, but what about those people you find difficult to love? What about those people who test your patience and when your love wavers and you think, really? Oh, and you find it hard? It's a very basic baseline question he wants us to ask. Do you love them? Do you love other believers? That's the new commandment Jesus brought in. Do you love them? Those people, these people here. Well, let's wrap this up. I'll say one more thing that isn't in the passage, but I think it's helpful to give us a little bit of balance here. Again, one of the dangers of 1 John is it can lead to an unhealthy introspection. constantly looking at ourselves, trying to assess our own heart, asking ourselves all these sorts of questions. That's one of the dangers we need to guard ourselves about. And that's why I think the balance I want to give you now is important, because it makes us look away from ourselves. There is another crucial assessment that should bring a Christian assurance. And it's one Jesus talks about in Matthew 16, verse 19, where Jesus says to the disciples, "I will give you the keys of the kingdom of heaven. And whatever you bind on earth will be bound in heaven, and whatever you loose on earth will be loosed in heaven." Now, what Jesus is doing there is he's giving to his disciples the authority to declare who is in the church and who isn't. They're not going to be able to do that perfectly, but they have the authority to do it. They have the authority to baptize people, to bring them into membership of the church, to say, this person's in, but that person isn't. We're not baptizing them. Their life is so inconsistent with a walk with Christ, we're not going to baptize them. Now, that helps us when it comes to this subject, because if you've been baptized and you've been brought into membership of the church, what that means is that the elders of the church have looked at your life and said, yeah, I see a credible profession of faith. I see evidence of right living, of right loving, right believing. If you struggle with this whole topic, you find you keep looking at yourself again and again, look to your baptism and your membership. And we do more than that as well. Robert Murray McShane says this. He says, "For every look at self, take 10 looks at Christ." If you're one of those people, and plenty of us can be like this, just keep on looking at yourself. Remember what Robert Murray McShane says. Take 10 looks at Christ. That's where your hope is in all of this. Well, we're going to sing, and then we'll open it up for discussion for a few moments.